You're listening to Bottom Shelf Bitcoin. This is episode 43. Relax. Enjoy your coffee. Okay. Hey, buddy. Good morning, everyone. Take a chill pill. What is it? Okay. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, the podcast that puts Bitcoin knowledge within everyone's reach. As always, I'm your host, Josh Humphrey, and today my guest is Janine. She is a privacy researcher and journalist. She focuses on Bitcoin and privacy and other kind of decentralized things. So we're going to be talking today about some of the recent events around Coinbase and some of that kind of stuff. Janine, welcome.
Yeah, thank you. This is actually my first time being on a podcast other than my own with two of my co-hosts, which is Block Digest. So this is going to be interesting for me.
Yeah, it is a little different being the one answering questions than the one asking questions, I think. But so before we get into kind of the other stuff, why don't you give us your background and how you got interested in all of this stuff?
Regarding Bitcoin, I've been interested in Bitcoin since around mid-2014, though I didn't really immerse myself in the space and actually start doing paid work until 2015 and 2016. I first heard about Bitcoin through an annotated transcript of a conversation between WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange and various other cypherpunks in 2012. Which ended up being published as a book called Cypherpunks, The Future of the Internet. And so even though I heard about it in 2012, I was interested in economics at the time, but I wasn't particularly interested in money itself, especially not digital money, which maybe we can get more into that at a later point. So Bitcoin just didn't stick out to me when I was reading the book, even though that's where I first heard about it. But then I got into it more in 2014 because I realized, like a lot of people, that Bitcoin was a different digital kind of money. And I realized how impactful that was. And I've been volunteering for shows. I initially volunteered for shows on the World Crypto Network between the end of 2015 and August 2017. But then I joined a new podcast on YouTube with Rick and Shinobi, also known as Brian Troll's Block Digest, which is where I still am. And I've continued to work in the space related to Bitcoin and privacy enhancing technology. And I'm also have a side interest in journalism, which I'm now trying to develop more and kind of incorporate it with Bitcoin as well.
Very cool. So I guess what is your background maybe before Bitcoin and before reading that book? Like what kind of got you to that point?
I'm not a computer scientist at all. My interest in Bitcoin and computers and privacy is purely a passion. I have no formal training outside of, you know, my own independent research and meeting people who have way more experience than me. My previous working experience was actually in like physical therapy with animals, specifically horses, because people with physical and mental disabilities often, they change and they can improve in terms of their ability to communicate and even to physically interact with other people when there are animals around. There's just, I mean, you probably have noticed that there's like this magical quality almost about animals that has that effect. And so I was involved with volunteering to use animals as a way to improve the lives of people with mental and physical disabilities. As a job, I've mostly done a lot of writing, like transcription and stuff. And so that's how I ended up getting an interest in journalism and WikiLeaks and things like that.
Very cool. Yeah, I actually have this not really related to Bitcoin, but I've got family members who previously worked at it's hippotherapy, right? Is that what it's called?
I think they just called it alternative therapy. I don't know if there's a special term for it.
Yeah. But yeah, I have family members that worked in like using horses and stuff for, that's very cool. Okay. Well, let's maybe transition into, some of the stuff with Coinbase. So if anybody listens to this, but isn't on Twitter, I guess maybe you might've missed it, but recently, Coinbase hired a team, incorporated a team, I guess, called Neutrino. Can you kind of give us some background on that and maybe what their purpose was in hiring that team?
Yeah, so this all started with a blog post written by Varun Sirivasan. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, but he's the director of engineering at Coinbase. And he made this post on February 19th. So, you know, only a couple of weeks ago. And the title was Welcoming Neutrino to Coinbase. Neutrino, as we discovered, was a blockchain analytics, or I would rather say blockchain surveillance company, which initially didn't raise too many flags because it's a very common thing for exchanges to be working with or even acquiring blockchain and analytics companies these days. And I'm not going to read the whole thing, but the key parts it were, they said Neutrino's technology is the best thing we've encountered in the space, and it will play an important role in legitimizing crypto, making it safer and more accessible for people all over the world. Led by some of the world's leading blockchain engineering and security experts, Neutrino will continue to operate as a standalone business based out of our London office. We're excited to welcome them to the Coinbase family. Now, I follow news around blockchain analytics and their companies as a necessary evil in my privacy research in tandem with following privacy-enhancing technology developments. And I had not heard of Neutrino before when I read this post. So when I saw the announcement, I thought, you know, I should probably look into that because it's potentially another company that I should be following. And so I was looking at the responses from people on also Twitter, which is where this kind of blew up. And I came across a tweet from Aryan Balaji, who shared a screenshot of the LinkedIn profile of the CEO of Neutrino, who is Giancarlo Russo. And he is now the ex-COO of a company that I was familiar with, which was called Hacking Team. And at first I thought, no, that can't be right. Coinbase would not hire this guy because Giancarlo Russo's name is plastered all over the internet, especially after 4 years ago. Hacking Team is rather an infamous group in InfoSec spaces, and someone at Coinbase must have at least done the bare minimum of Googling, or as I use DuckDuckGo, so I would say DuckDuckGoing his name. Right. And sure enough, I find Neutrino's website, neutrino.nu. They have a pop-up announcement that says we've been acquired by Coinbase, and they list two products. The first one is Xflow Inspect, and just N by itself and then Inspect, which is for government clients. And then they also have Xflow Insight, which is marketed to financial services companies with, quote, special features to support your compliance procedures by assessing the KYC AML risk of your crypto financial assets. This is most likely what Coinbase would use. And then I went further through their website, and the only people listed as part of the company are Giancarlo Russo as the CEO. There's also Marco Valeri as the CRO and Alberto Ornaghi, who is the CTO. And so it was even worse than I initially thought, because all three of them are from Hacking Team. And at this point, I was literally physically shaking with rage and fear at the thought that one of the largest Bitcoin and cryptocurrency exchanges would not only give these people money, but would welcome them into their corporate so-called family.
Yeah, it's... And so for those who maybe are not familiar with Hacking Team and Hacking Team's history, can you kind of give us a little bit of background on that? Because I, before Bitcoin, I really had not spent a lot of time looking into InfoSec and OpSec and these different privacy and security things until I started really understanding Bitcoin. And so I hadn't heard of them until all of this blew up. So can you kind of give us a little background on the things that they've been involved in?
Yeah, so the history of Hacking Team spans almost 15 years, part of which is now on the public internet because they were hacked, which I will get to that part. But I'll try to compress as much of that history as possible. Basically, Hacking Team is a Milan-based company that sold, as their website says, I don't know if they have this quote specifically, but they market offensive, intrusive, and surveillance capabilities to governments, law enforcement agencies, and corporations. The last part, they claim that they don't sell to corporations, but as we would find out, they actually did that. It was founded in 2003 after Valeri and Ornaghi sold Man in the Middle, a tax software called EtherCap. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it either, but like a lot of the stuff I do is just read or I read, so I don't hear it verbally. But that was created in 2001, and they didn't create it with the intention of selling it to law enforcement. It was purely for their own purposes because they came from a hacker culture, which I suspect was probably malicious. But to the Milan Police Department, this was an opportunity to, you know, acquire some useful tech that they could use for their purposes, whether legitimate or otherwise. And so their intent with the software was not even to work with law enforcement, but the police recruited them after the fact, and they basically formed Hacking Team, the company, as a way to then interface with not only the Italian government, but other governments in Europe, and then eventually all around the world. And there's an article from Foreign Policy that focuses on Hacking Team's CEO, who is named David, and it's titled Fear This Man, and it details his involvement. He was there since the founding, and according to Foreign Policy, they created what would become the remote control system, which is codenamed Galileo. And apparently they created this in an underground apartment sometime between 2003 and 2004. There's actually a Chaos Communication Congress presentation. For anyone who doesn't know, that's one of the most popular hacker/infosec conferences probably in the world. And there was a presentation in December 2013 by two security researchers titled To Protect and Infect: The Militarization of the Internet. And this was before Hacking Team actually became infamous to the wider world, not only to the InfoSec community. And you can find that recording on their website. But in that presentation, they actually show one of Hacking Team's advertisements for their services and at about 25 minutes in. And their tagline was the hacking suite for government interception. So it was very clear at that point that that's what they were focusing on. The first documented attacks by Hacking Team against activists or journalists appeared in 2012 that we know of, that were widely publicized, when the Moroccan government used their tools to target a citizen journalist organization called Mafakinch, and also a blogger from the United Arab Emirates named Ahmed Mansour, who's actually an engineering graduate from the University of Colorado. But then he turned to blogging about internet censorship and surveillance in the United Arab Emirates and that region in general for a long time. And actually, the 2-year anniversary of his arrest is coming up soon, on March 19th. About 1 week after his arrest in 2017, the United Nations actually described his detention as a direct attack on the legitimate work of human rights defenders. And he subsequently spent an entire year prior to his trial in solitary confinement without being allowed to communicate with a lawyer or his family. He has 4 children. And assuming the full sentence is served, he'll still be in prison for another 8 years. So This is, yeah, it's one of the many, many victims of, you know, governments or even corporations who use their software of Hacking Team to target activists. And actually, because of Mansour's reports about the exploits that were used to target him and these unknown numbers of people around the world, he was given multiple awards. And for the fact that because of those reports, They were able to develop, security researchers were able to develop mitigations. And so other people were protected because of him, even though he had to suffer for that. And because of Hacking Team's involvement, Reporters Without Borders actually classified them as one of the top five corporate enemies of the internet in 2013. So fast forward to 2015, a hacker going by the pseudonym of Phineas Fisher hijacks the Twitter account of Hacking Team and uses it to leak hundreds of gigabytes of their internal emails spanning several years between principals of the company itself, but also with their government and corporate clients, as well as copies of their code. That actually, the copy of the code might have been in another leak that WikiLeaks published called the Spy Files. I'm not sure which of the two archives that's in, but it's in one of those. So basically, their code was leaked, their emails were leaked, and it was revealed that they had not only lied and tried to conceal which governments and intelligence agencies they were servicing, but they had even backdoored the surveillance suite that they sold to these clients. In other words, they backdoored their backdoors. And you can see this in an email with Marco Valeri, one of the Neutrino team members, or maybe possibly already a former team member, in February 2015 regarding specifically systems that were deployed in Azerbaijan, Morocco, and Italy. And this leak was a serious blow to their business. The exposure not only was embarrassing, except for the CEO, David, who, according to his responses, must be a psychopath who feels no shame because he said, oh, it's not a big deal. But wow. It prompted even more scrutiny from security researchers, civil society groups regarding their activities. And after Citizen Lab and Privacy International reported on this extensively in 2014, the Italian government actually placed them under a restricted license that required them to apply for permission for every single export of their products, where they would have to specify where it would be used and I think also for what purpose. So in many instances, they actually had their requests frozen or blocked when they were seeking permission. And so Hacking Team in their emails claimed that they lost hundreds of thousands of euros because of this. And unfortunately, with the nature of the new keyword is cyber mercenaries, they tend to have a lot of government and intelligence contacts. And so they managed to lobby themselves into a less restricted license in April 2015, which was right before all of their emails were dumped and made searchable by WikiLeaks in July of that year. And then almost out of nowhere then in March 2016, the Italian government revoked their global export license. And it was suspected that this decision came about as a response to news of the murder of an Italian graduate student in Cairo, which Egypt was a client of Hacking Team. So it's suspected that either just because of the relationship and that made them uncomfortable, or maybe possibly their software was used to target him. It's very unclear. I'm not aware of whether that was ever confirmed, but regardless, the Italian government revoked their license and Hacking Team went really, really quiet after that because their brand was now toxic, not only to the people that they were targeting who were now aware that they were, you know, that they were attacking them, but also those who were doing the targeting who thought, well, it's probably not a good idea to be working with these people because not only, you know, if people find out, that looks bad for us, but also it turns out they're backdooring their software. That's not great. So Russo, Valeri, and Ornaghi claim to have founded Neutrino in 2016, which means that they got to work basically right away, jumping ship and making money again. Giacomo Zucco, who was in Milan at the time, and he reported this to Bitcoin Magazine, said that they tried to make contact seeking investment from him or his business in late 2016. And then he was given a live demo of their blockchain analysis software in February 2017. So they really did like get to work right away on like not only forming a company, but trying to build, you know, a new product that they could sell. And Giacomo at the time was not aware who Russo and Ornaghi were. I don't know if he just didn't recognize their names or their faces. I probably wouldn't have recognized their faces, but I would have recognized their names. But he was not even impressed with their work, especially because they wouldn't let him test it himself, and they were claiming to use some kind of secret algorithm. So he promptly rejected them for that. And then when he Googled their names, he was like, oh, no, definitely don't. Not even going to recommend these to a client. And according to Jesse Powell of Kraken, Neutrino also gave a demo to his compliance team in November 2018. So just several months ago. And he even tweeted a screenshot of what their product included, which was useful because it directly identified in the evaluation, which was likely for the software I mentioned before, Xflow, Nsight, what kind of characteristics it had, including what assets it supported, Bitcoin, Bitcoin Cash, Litecoin, Ethereum Dash, USD Tether, for some reason. And this was the reason that Brian Armstrong would later cite they chose Neutrino was the support for multiple crypto assets. And so there's a bunch of interesting things in Jesse's screenshot that he shared about like how it worked. But then the killer comment was at the end where he said, or his compliance team wrote that they were a possible risk because Neutrino's founder is also the founder of Hacking Team, an Italian cybersecurity firm that is known to pass information to Russian firms closely associated with the FSB, which is the successor to the KGB. So that's another interesting storyline to go on if you want to know more history about them. But yeah, that disqualified them from being acquired or having any business relationship with Kraken. Fast forward, you know, a few months, it's now become clear that Coinbase either failed to come to the same ethical conclusion about them, or maybe was not aware as they should have been of this history. And so on, they ended up signing an acquisition deal with Neutrino on February 15th. Then they announced it, as I said, on February 19th for $13.5 million. And then within 2 weeks, we saw the birth of Delete Coinbase.
Yeah. So, and I had seen, you know, people say prior, like just back in 2017, 2018, from things like refusing to do SegWit and supporting contentious hard forks and things like that, you know, here and there, this Delete Coinbase, but it became very concentrated very quickly. From my viewpoint of this, and it's, you know, it's hard for me to look at this and go, either Coinbase just doesn't care about the Bitcoin ethos, or and maybe even malicious, or they're just that tone deaf. It is very, I mean, I don't know. It's hard for me to really think they're that tone deaf. And I agree with you. Like the response or the commentary from Jesse Powell of Kraken is very telling of, like, you know, clearly they saw that this was a conflict of interest or a potential problem. So I you know, how did Coinbase miss this?
Yeah, that was really my primary question. I initially, like, it was very hard to assume the best of these people considering their decision, but I initially assumed the best and thought, okay, maybe they just look hard enough into these people before acquiring them, which is why the first tweet that I made specifically addressing Brian Armstrong was, you know, if on the off chance that you really are oblivious about this, and then I basically did a whole long thread about their history, citing specific emails from each of the people that were publicly known to be associated with Neutrino, just in the hopes that they would realize quickly this was a mistake, we're not going to do this anymore, like we're not going to associate with them anymore. And it was, as you know, we'll get to, it was really disappointing to find out that actually they did know and they didn't see a problem with it. Yeah.
Yeah. So then this Delete Coinbase hashtag and movement starts up. And I mean, I was one that closed my account. I had previously, I don't know, it's been a couple years, used them. And then just, like I said, from the other things, the supporting Bcash, the sneak launching of Bcash, the refusal or very delayed implementation of batching and SegWit and these things that just were not healthy for the network. I had just stopped using it, but I had never gotten around to deleting my account. So I went in and finally deleted my account, and I didn't have the problems that some people had because I had nothing left on there. But we saw with some people, they started having issues when they were trying to delete their account. Do you want to go into that a little bit?
Yeah. So before we discuss in general about delete Coinbase, one of the problems was that when the delete Coinbase hashtag started getting really popular, and it was specifically centered around people actually going to delete their accounts. I think this was on February 27th, because I think Udi Wertheimer was the main person to make it really popular, because he announced that he was deleting his account, even though he said he didn't use it much and wasn't a big customer. I've never had a Coinbase account, so my use of that hashtag was simply to share updates on the topic, I also obviously used it to see who else was deleting their account and were they having problems, and were other people finding information that was useful to the topic. But what ended up happening is that I noticed a couple hours into the hashtag getting really popular with people who were specifically saying, I'm deleting my account, goodbye, was that they were saying, oh, I can't delete my account because I have a dust amount in it. And for anyone who doesn't know what a dust amount is, it's a amount of Bitcoin that is too small to send a transaction. Now, in Bitcoin has its own dust limit. I don't quite remember what it is right now, but it's basically you can't send a transaction below this amount because the fee to send the transaction would be worth more than sending the transaction. So it wouldn't make economic sense. But Coinbase, I think, has their own dust amount where it doesn't make sense for them to transfer, you know, whatever amount of Bitcoin this is out of their cold storage or their hot wallet, wherever it currently is, wherever they want to take it, and then have that go to some external wallet that's your choice. So they have their own dust amount. And so if anyone on Coinbase had, you know, an amount that was below this dust limit, they would not be able to withdraw that money from the account. And obviously that's a problem, because if they can't withdraw the money from the account, they can't close their account. That was one of the requirements. And that, you know, the part about not being able to close your account if you still have a balance is not that unusual. That's generally a policy for even other banks that are not crypto banks, like Coinbase's. They usually have, unless they like accuse you of doing something criminal with your money, they will have you remove your balance before closing your account. So what ingeniously happened, and I'm not sure who came up with it, if it was Udi or not, but Udi was really spearheading this, where he told people like, hey, Coinbase has an internal transfer system, which I was familiar with, even though I'd never had an account, where you can send, you know, any amount of Bitcoin to another Coinbase account, which, you know, there's no fee for that or anything. And so he thought, well, what if the people with dust amounts send their dust to another Coinbase account? Like, there's no point in you keeping that small amount of Bitcoin, because if you can't withdraw it or whatever, like, the only way you could get it off is if you buy more Bitcoin from Coinbase. And who would want to do that if in these circumstances? So people started creating a delete Coinbase trust chain where they would pass along their dust to other accounts that also had dust. And once this dust built up that passed over the dust limit, then that person could withdraw that Bitcoin and, you know, keep it if they wanted to, or send it to a charity. That was suggested almost at the start, to have that be the end route. Because that was what was also being suggested with other trust chain things going on with the Lightning Network and also the Paynims from Samurai Wallet. So that was pretty hilarious, because I just, it like, it was such a great moment because between like February 19th and the 27th, which is when that kicked off, it was like a really long period of rage and sadness and disappointment for me around this whole thing. And so to see people like subversively use Coinbase's system against them that was preventing them from exercising their exit right, it was hilarious and beautiful at the same time. So I'm really glad that happened.
Yeah, I really enjoyed seeing them turn that feature that Coinbase had implemented, I guess more when they were trying to do this payments thing and such. I think that was the original idea. And also because these aren't, you know, Coinbase accounts aren't individual accounts with your own individual private keys. They're all in this like mass, which allows you to send Bitcoin between Coinbase users, right? Because all they're doing is updating their internal accounting database. Then to turn that on itself and use that as the exit strategy was really clever.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, even after that point, people were still having issues. And now it's very unclear still whether Coinbase's system just had bugs or maybe it was over. I don't know how many people were deleting their accounts, but possibly it was being overwhelmed with the number of delete account requests. Or most maliciously, it's possible that they were disabling this in order to prevent people from deleting their accounts as part of this campaign. That's possible. But regardless, people to this day are still trying to delete their account. And they're being given a weird excuse that even when they complete all the steps, they have no balance, blah, blah, blah. They're being told that they just can't close their account at this time. And they're not given a reason for that. So some of them have actually contacted support and said, I'm trying to close my account. It says I have all the steps done. Why are you not letting me leave? And they say, oh, we have to send this request to an account specialist and they will get back to you in 5 to 7 business days, possibly longer, which is just bizarre. Like, why? What kind of system are you running that you need to have a specialist for account closures? That's just ridiculous. Some people are even being asked to provide identifying information in order to.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, it's really ridiculous. Like, oh yes, I'm trying to basically boycott you because you might, you know, give my data or have already leaked my data to someone other party, and you're asking me for more information that's sensitive. Like, that's insane. I can't believe that they thought that was acceptable.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my gosh. So, well, and prior to this, Coinbase did not have a great reputation for their customer support anyway. So, I mean, this whole thing of a account specialist is just laughable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then, you know, there's enough people closing their accounts. Coinbase finally decides to respond or I guess try to explain themselves first before they made the secondary response. And they came out with an explanation of why they had hired Neutrino in the first place. You want to go into that?
Yeah, so they responded in two different ways. The first one, I can't, because it came out from various news outlets. I think this was still late February. But they basically, I think it was after February 27th, they sent a statement to like Breaker Mag. I don't know if they sent it to CoinDesk because I don't read CoinDesk, but they sent it to Breaker Mag. Yeah, they sent it to Breaker Mag, The Block, Kyle Torpy individually got a response, and also to Bitcoin Magazine. They sent responses. I don't know if these outlets had specifically asked for them. I think most of them did. And that response said, yes, we are aware of the background of people at Neutrino and that they were previously affiliated with Hacking Team. And this is not a direct quote, I'm paraphrasing, but they then had obviously this whole paragraph like marketing stuff about, you know, we care about our customers and we're building an open financial system and, you know, all of that. And that was not really enough for most people. I mean, it not only was it not enough, but it was enraging because now they had confirmed, yes, we did know about this. It wasn't a, as Brian Armstrong would later say, a gap in our diligence where they just didn't know or they didn't look into it. They obviously had, but for some reason they didn't see it as a problem. And it was also kind of weird that they wouldn't publish a statement directly until obviously Brian Armstrong's response later on, early March. But they were just sending responses to media and it wasn't it wasn't coming from a particular person. It was just a broad Coinbase response, a Coinbase spokesperson. So that was disappointing. And it didn't do anything to quell people's fears because they were just brushing it aside and saying it's, I mean, they didn't literally say this, but it was interpreted by many people as this isn't a big deal. We're just going to keep going along as things are, which was unacceptable because I was, especially from the start, I was in a state of this needs to, like, people need to know about this. Something needs to be done about this. And actually, it kind of surprised me, but I was looking back through the responses and I didn't see anyone involved in this whole campaign actually calling for the people from Hacking Team to be fired. Like, I didn't personally make that demand. All I demanded of Brian Armstrong and other executives at Coinbase was specifically to explain themselves. And I felt that they had not done that well enough. And obviously there was an implication, like, you should probably get rid of these people. They're dangerous and they've hurt people, or that what they have built has hurt people and enabled others to hurt people. But I don't remember actually seeing a direct demand saying you should fire them. It was mostly like, this is a threat. How should we deal with this? Yeah.
And so then, and I'm trying to remember, was this all at the same time? Or I think there was a difference here, but when they came out and said that, I guess the delete Coinbase thing continued and they faced enough backlash that they came out and at some point said more or less that they had hired Neutrino because their prior analytics branch had leaked information to a third party that information hadn't really been disclosed to the public as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, so that was on March 3rd. Basically, I was looking through some tweets that had the delete Coinbase hashtag in them. And I noticed one from a guy named Austin Alexander, who is also at Kraken. And he was commenting on an interview that the director of institutional sales, Christine Sandler, had made at an outlet called Cheddar, which I think does business news and entertainment commentary. And it wasn't publicized that much. It was just, oh, this Cheddar did an interview with this person. And actually the main topic was about the fact that they had recently listed XRP / Ripple, which many people suspected was kind of, if it was not planned much further in advance, many people suspected that that was their way of, like, trying to cover up the controversy by saying, look, we've listed another token, and especially a token that we're getting, like, a lot of trolls that are always telling us to list it. Look, we're making you happy. But obviously the funniest part of that is because of the controversy around Coinbase, there was even, like, I think her name is Tiffany Hayden, who's, like, a very influential person in the Ripple community.
Yeah.
She actually made a statement saying, don't use Coinbase because of, you know, Neutrino and blah, 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 which was hilarious. It basically backfired on Ripple. And, you know, people are already talking about the fact that the so-called Coinbase effect, which is where the price of a cryptocurrency, like, shoots up when it gets listed on Coinbase, that has been decreasing over time. Like, there's not as much of an effect, but I would not be surprised if part of the reason that it didn't, you know, increase in price that much was because the listing was on Coinbase and there was a controversy, and either people didn't hear about it because of all the other stuff happening around Coinbase news, or because people just weren't trading as much on Coinbase out of maybe some fear of what was going on. But yeah, so on March 3rd, the director of institutional sales said in that interview that they needed to migrate away because their previous provider was, quote, selling client data to outside sources. And for some reason, I cannot fathom, they thought that that was a good justification for bringing on former members of Hacking Team. Like, that was a preferable alternative to the, like, I don't know how that could be preferable in any universe, but okay. And I don't read, as I said, I don't read CoinDesk, but according to CoinDesk, a Coinbase spokesperson has since claimed that Sandler simply misspoke, and they have never shared our customers' personally identifiable information about any third-party blockchain analysis vendor. Now, misspeaking is something they've been doing a lot lately, and that's a pretty grave thing to misspeak about, justifying your acquisition of that kind of company by saying, hey, your data was already at risk. And I've already given this response on my other podcast, Block Digest, but I'll repeat it again here. I just want to make a suggestion, which is perhaps Sandler did indeed misspeak. And in terms of the nature or classification of the vendor, maybe she was a bit confused and she was, when she was referencing who was selling the client data. And maybe she confused a blockchain analysis service with a KYC compliance service because, for example, there is, like, a lot of these blockchain analysis companies tend to work with companies that may also do blockchain analysis, but they're specifically focused on, you know, KYC AML and possibly collecting and holding identity information for compliance reasons. And so, for example, there's a company called CipherTrace, which is a blockchain analysis company, and they're partnered with another company called IdentityMind, which handles collection and storage of personally identifiable information for the purposes of KYC. And so for Coinbase to clarify that they specifically did not share client data, or is, like, initially they said her statement was client data, and the spokesperson clarified that it was personally identifiable information, which they're not necessarily the same thing. Companies are very inconsistent with how they legally classify personally identifiable information. But anyway, it could have been possible that Coinbase was partnered with a blockchain analysis vendor who was also partnered with another company that did, like, identity document handling and, you know, verifying fraud and stuff like that, protecting against fraud. So maybe as part of their partnership with the blockchain analysis company, they also sent, you know, client data, possibly personally identifiable information, to another company that was not a blockchain analysis vendor, but still was doing that as part of that process. So their statement could still be true. They did not send that information to a blockchain analysis vendor, but they sent it to a related company doing something else, and that company misused the data. It's very unclear because this is basically the, you know, it's single sentences that Coinbase has given in response to these allegations. So it's very unclear at this point, and many people have many questions. But does that explanation make sense?
Yeah, I think I see what you're saying. But yeah, they have not taken the step in coming. Coinbase has left it murky too, because, right, like you said, single sentence answers to potentially nuanced situations if we're giving them the benefit of the doubt, which at this point I don't really think they deserve. But they have a long way to go in explaining things well. And also, this was, I mean, right, like, besides, I mean, you can say whether listing XRP is a misstep or not, but this is not their only questionable hire recently, is that correct?
Yeah, sorry, having a blank about what their last hire was.
I'm trying to think that might have been questionable.
Do you mean Catherine Hahn?
I think that was it.
Yeah, so that, funnily enough, that it's funny because Roger Ver recently reshared the tweet about her joining the board of directors in the summer of 2017, which was actually the tweet that makes the start of my thread, which was in the summer of 2017 when it was initially announced. And that was the day that I said, I am socially pre-committing to never use Coinbase. Right. And that was in itself a joke because Vitalik had made a similar social pre-commitment to say, like, I will never advise ICOs or be involved in an ICO. And then he ended up being involved in an ICO with, I think it's called OhMyzGo or something like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was funny because that was the tweet that actually started my Coinbase thread. And I was like, every time some weird or bad news about Coinbase came out, I would update that thread with the new information. Gotcha. But yeah, the reason, for anyone who doesn't know, the reason I thought that hire of Catherine Hahn as a board member, by the way, it was International Women's Day yesterday, so I'll just mention that she is the only board member at Coinbase who is a woman. So I'm sure that was part of the reason why they hired her. But she is actually a former federal prosecutor, and people don't particularly like her because she was involved in the prosecution of the Force/Bridges case, which, you know, you might think, oh, well, isn't that a good thing? Because Force and Bridges were the corrupt officers who ended up, you know, doing a bunch of nefarious things with regards to the case against Ross Ulbricht and possibly, you know, tampered with evidence and tried to enrich themselves with some of the Bitcoin funds that they got access to. But the reason I don't like her in particular is because even though she prosecuted them, she then didn't make any effort, even though she was in a position to, she didn't make any effort to then say, like, maybe we should do a retrial of Ross Ulbricht, because if they tampered with evidence and if there was just general corruption involved in the investigation, this needs to be redone. And maybe he would get a different sentence if there was actually some kind of justice process involved. So, yeah, a lot of people have, you know, they have problems with her for that reason, but also just because it's kind of a big deal for a crypto exchange to acquire someone for a influential position like board of directors who is a prosecutor and obviously involved with regulation and stuff. It's not surprising considering Coinbase clearly just wants to become the crypto bank of the space. But yeah, that was probably the biggest controversial hire that I've seen up until Neutrino.
Yeah. Well, then let's talk about this, like this delete Coinbase movement. It's and maybe the importance of social pressure on these companies. To me, this seems like a very good thing, and I think I've seen other things in the past that in maybe more of a physical space of protests and things that got violent that I don't necessarily approve of. But I was very encouraged by people holding this company accountable for their actions.
Yeah. So basically the delete Coinbase hashtag, I mean, I didn't create it, but it's clearly based off of other campaigns like Delete Uber. What was another one? There was another delete campaign for a corporation I can't think of off the top of my head. But there's been a few where people just, they get angry about something that the company has done or not done, and they say, like, they start this campaign to encourage people to delete their accounts and not do business with that company anymore. And obviously, like, I haven't had a Coinbase account, so my involvement in it has nothing to do with me actually having to delete an account. But I was just seeing a lot of ethical issues and privacy issues with this acquisition. And also to mention, I was not like the leader or anything. This was a very grassroots and, you know, broad group of people who are doing this. When I first started building the thread about the history of Hacking Team, there were a lot of people who were not only helping to signal boost what I was talking about, but also bringing up new things that I didn't know about. And like, obviously I mentioned Udi, who started the Dust Chain, and then Andreas Antonopoulos was signal boosting it. Whale Panda, Mr. Hoddle, Chelsea Palmer, Giacomo Zucco, John Light, Peter Todd, Nick Carter, Ansel Lindner, Austin Alexander from Kraken, and Francis Poulet. And obviously I won't get everyone's names, but I wanted to credit a bunch of people just to, make it clear that I was by far not the only person that was doing this. I felt it was very personal and not really directed or coordinated very much. In addition to the people that were spreading awareness in their own personal capacity, there were journalists from Bitcoin Magazine and Breaker Mag and The Block who were involved in it from a journalistic perspective. Some of them were making statements as well personally, but they were also writing about it and covering it. For example, Colin Harper from Bitcoin Magazine reached out not only to me, but also to another woman named Zineb, who was actually one of the citizen journalists from Morocco who was targeted by her own government using Hacking Team software. And she made a statement in Bitcoin Magazine about that and what she thought of Coinbase acquiring the people who helped her government to target her and her friends and colleagues. So that was a big deal. There was also David Morris from Breaker Mag and various writers at The Block. The interesting part, from what I can tell, the only two exchanges that have publicly criticized Coinbase's decision were BISC and Kraken. BISC is obviously on the complete opposite end of the spectrum from an infrastructure standpoint from Coinbase because they're a decentralized exchange. And then Jesse Powell is known for standing up to overreaches of regulators in the past. And so it clearly struck him as another opportunity to differentiate Kraken in terms of their values, even though they're still obviously a centralized exchange. And to quote Danny Brewster, I think he said something like, "The more people who shout this from the rooftops, the better." And considering the kind of people involved in Neutrino, or possibly formally involved, obviously there's a possibility for retaliation because, as I said, the acquisition was $13.5 million, which is, some people think that that's a small amount of money. It's not a small amount of money to me. And for a group of people who have been struggling for the past 2 or 3 years because their brand got completely destroyed, I wouldn't be surprised if that was kind of a godsend for them to, get out of the pit of everyone hates you because you're awful people. That being said, I think there are multiple forms of social pressure, and I'm actually going to be a bit subversive and reference what Coinbase's CTO, Balaji Srinivasan, said in his 2013 speech about voice and exit. He said, "There is a fundamental concept in political science, the concept of voice versus exit. A company or a country is in decline. You can try voice or you can try exit. Voice is basically changing the system from within, whereas exit is leaving to create a new system, a new startup, or to join a competitor sometimes. Loyalty can modulate this. Sometimes that's patriotism, which is voluntary, and sometimes it's lock-in where involuntary barriers to exit exist. Exit is really a meta-concept. It's about alternatives. It's a meta-concept that subsumes competition, forking, founding, and physical emigration. It means giving people tools to reduce influence or bad policies on their lives without getting involved in politics, the tools of peacefully opting out." And I think that really encompasses what happened, because how ironic that 6 years later his own customers would be struggling to exercise this option of exit by deleting their accounts and not really being able to. I think Delete Coinbase was rare, because as I said, there wasn't really a call to even you know, see, I think I saw a few, maybe one or two people said, you know, Brian Armstrong should step down for this or whatever. But most of it was just spreading awareness. Whereas, you know, delete Uber and delete Facebook, that ended up with the CEOs. In the case of delete Uber, I think the CEO stepped down. Delete Facebook, obviously that didn't happen. Zuckerberg is still there.
Right.
But that those calls were being made. And there was harassment of employees, regardless of whether that's justified or regardless of their role or power within those companies. And I didn't really see any of that happening with Delete Coinbase. It really was focused on awareness. And as I said, the only thing that I really demanded of Brian Armstrong was to explain himself. I didn't say step down. I didn't even say fire. None of my tweets say like fire hacking team, although I think that would be best for everyone. But I didn't see any harassment going on, and I personally made it one of my rules for engaging in social pressure online is that I don't punch down. So I don't target people who are, first of all, less powerful than I am or broadly in a position that they have very little power, because I just think that's, you know, I mean, obviously people of less power can do horrible things, but I feel like my time is more productively spent going after people who are in a position of higher power than I am. And I also decided early on, particularly with Delete Coinbase, that I wouldn't target my comments at Coinbase employees that were not in upper management, because they not only don't have as much power as obviously Brian Armstrong does, but there was no way of knowing without them saying, you know, publicly how much they knew about the acquisition, whether they were involved with it, whether they approved of it. And maybe they couldn't say that because of their, you know, position in the company, and maybe they weren't in a position to speak out about it. And so I wanted to not only not engage in harassment of that kind, but I also wanted to leave the door open in case any of them did want to contact me, that they wouldn't feel uncomfortable doing that if they saw like a bunch of people from Coinbase getting personally attacked for just being involved with the company. So that was important to me. And my goal with this whole thing, being involved with it, was to encourage people to consider the ethics of the decision, including people within Coinbase, because obviously if you're making their own employees aware of the situation, they can influence it from the inside. And that might even be more powerful than a bunch of people on Twitter who are saying, you know, we won't stand for this anymore, we're going to delete our accounts and what have you. Like, they might have a bigger influence.
Wow. Yeah, that's very good. And I hadn't even thought about it on that level of leaving the door open for other people to approach you. So good job with that. Quickly, let's, I guess, kind of to go into what ended up, or I guess maybe we don't know that everything's resolved, but the Brian Armstrong's most recent post as far as the action that they've taken.
Yeah, so Jesse Powell actually did a good breakdown in a podcast that Kraken did about this, which I was like, it kind of surprised me that they would spend so much time on it, considering they're obviously in a similar position, being pressured to implement various KYC AML policies. And they even were one of the companies that evaluated Neutrino. But then again, if they want to demonstrate that they have, you know, that they consider the values of the company very important when it comes to decisions like this, then maybe that's important for them to share with everyone. Yeah, so the thing that stuck out to me about Brian Armstrong's statement was, one, the thing where he said that the reason they chose Neutrino was because they supported multiple crypto assets, whereas I guess the other vendors that they looked at didn't. And the other part that particularly angered me was where he thought it was important to point out that, oh, the people at Neutrino are no longer affiliated with Hacking Team. And I thought, yes, Brian, they are no longer affiliated with Hacking Team, but why are they no longer affiliated with Hacking Team? It was not a choice. It was because hacking team. I don't even know if the company like is still alive in a legal sense, or whether, you know, maybe all of these spinoff companies are, the purpose of them is to funnel money to hacking team somehow. But basically their brand died like 3 years ago because they were involved with like governments that were murdering journalists and murdering activists. And just, you know, most of the time, in some places, not using the tools in a way that was even compliant with their own legal system. So yes, they're no longer affiliated with Hacking Team because there was a previous campaign to take them down as Hacking Team. And as far as I can see, it was successful because one of the things that they complained about in their emails was that, like, even in 2014, before the hack, was that they were on the verge of bankruptcy. They were burning a lot of cash. And, you know, I think that them no longer being affiliated with Hacking Team because Hacking Team died is a good thing. But we also have to recognize that it was not their choice. It was forced upon them because of their actions. And so, yeah, they're no longer affiliated with Hacking Team. And we have no evidence whatsoever. Like, people have been making the argument that, you know, maybe they've changed or they should be given a second chance. I believe in second chances, but I also think I require of people to demonstrate that they have not only recognized the consequences of their actions and also made steps to, you know, I don't like at least apologize or do something to recognize that your actions were bad, they hurt a lot of people, and that you're going to do something to fix it and, you know, change your behavior in the future. We have not seen that, at least not publicly, from any of these people. And I think it should be public because obviously they had a global influence in so many countries. It really should be public for that. They should make that kind of statement public about what steps they are taking to change. We have no evidence that that has taken place. So why do they deserve a second chance? Why do they deserve to have a position of power over, you know, apparently Coinbase has, you know, 10 million customers. Maybe that's just account numbers, who knows, but they have a lot of customers. Why do these people from Hacking Team deserve to be in a position of power over potentially hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people? What did they do to deserve that? And how have they proven that they won't abuse that position as they have in the past? So,
yeah, Brian, I mean, they...
Go ahead.
Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, I just wanted to, Brian Armstrong, I mean, I don't know if it's because of his position, like all of Coinbase is obviously a Silicon Valley company. And I've noticed that a lot of Silicon Valley companies they're very far removed from the implications of what happens when people are forced to give identifying information, when their privacy is taken away from them, when their control over their data is taken away from them. They don't seem to understand the implications of that. And, you know, as I said, yesterday was International Women's Day, and they ran this whole marketing campaign about, you know, what kinds of issues women face in the financial world. And the problem, I want to criticize them in the context of that, because they keep saying that they're trying to supposedly build an open financial system that, as they were promoting yesterday, they think is inclusive to women. But one of the things they didn't mention in that piece that holds people back, especially women in the financial world, is the risks that are presented by requiring identity as part of your financial life, and the steps that banks and transaction processors take to destroy your privacy even beyond that. Of course, they didn't mention it because it's not only an issue that they don't solve, but they actually exacerbate it. For example, like if I were to sign up to PayPal, I would actually be required to give less identity documentation to them than I would to Coinbase, which should seem insane to people.
Yeah.
For them to say, like, we're building an open financial system, but we're less open than PayPal, or we have less we have more restrictions than PayPal. That doesn't make any sense. And the reason that this is particularly an issue to me, especially with regards to the Quadriga case, for anyone who doesn't know, that's a crypto exchange in Canada that recently lost millions of dollars, somehow related to the death of their founder, or possible death. Like, there's a whole, it's a whole mess of information right now. But I saw recently that it's been alleged that over, you know, a few different times that the co-founder of Quadriga actually has a history of being involved in identity theft schemes. And the last thing you want to have in a person with power over the financial lives of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people, would be someone who is willing to exploit that position to engage in that kind of behavior. And identity theft is a risk for both men and women, but as a woman, it's a great concern of mine in particular, because every time I give out identity information, whether it's, you know, just my name online, or, you know, to a government, or when I cross a border, or when I have to sign up for a bank account, or whatever, when I'm giving that information, I'm always thinking, okay, who is going to have access and knowledge to my identity? How could they use that to target me for even reasons other than getting, you know, taking my money, but, you know, other things that they could do? And that was why the Neutrino acquisition was such a crisis point for me from that standpoint, because what identity information would these people be getting access to as part of their KYC analysis process if that is something that they would do? And would they exploit it? I think they've shown throughout their history that they just might be willing to do that. So, privacy in money and transactions and financial related matters is important to me for that reason, because, you know, every time you give out your identity, that's a risk, because a lot of these identity documents are not created or constructed or used in a way that is particularly secure. And I think that this, like Quadriga and Coinbase with the Neutrino acquisition, are examples of the extreme hazards that poses to so many people.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm trying to think, maybe it was Blockstream or somebody that had come up with it, you know, as compared to Google's prior motto, which was don't be evil, was their motto, can't be evil, right? Like that they want to position themselves in such a way that they cannot, even if somebody within the company chose to try and do something malicious, they just wouldn't even be in a position to do that. And that's just like completely at odds with what's going on here.
Yeah, I think, there might be multiple companies that use that motto, but I think recently it was Casa HODL, which does the Lightning hardware wallet. I think they use that motto.
Okay.
Yeah.
Jeremy Welsh and Jameson Lopp and those guys, those are good guys too.
And particularly if anyone would be interested, Jameson Lopp he's done a presentation about, you know, how to secure your life in so many different aspects in terms of like what identity documents you possess, and like in particular how your driver's license information can be abused by multiple different people. Like, most people don't even think of that, but that's a big one. He did a presentation on this because he was personally affected by, you know, someone, you know, trying to use that information and exploiting specifically the phone companies in order to, you know, make a report to police that I can't remember what they alleged, but it was something like there was a hostage situation or something. And
they pretended to be him and that he was going to kill a bunch of people and got SWAT teams sent out to his house.
Yeah. And so he and his family could have easily gotten hurt. And so he's very aware of the consequences of, like, you know, who has your information and how can they abuse it to hurt you. So I would recommend looking at that presentation if anyone's interested in that kind of, you know, OPSEC, if they need it, or if you just want to do it for fun.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's transition then, and if you've got time to, if you want to talk a little bit about your, I'm interested in.
If you've been listening to the show recently, you'll know I launched BitcoinMeritBadge.com, an online store where you can buy Velcro-backed patches to celebrate accomplishments and culture in Bitcoin. It's a great way to support my work and show off your love for Bitcoin at the same time. But what you might not know is that my manufacturer, Patcheon, is also a Bitcoin-friendly business. Patcheon has been accepting Bitcoin since 2011 and accepts on-chain and Lightning Network Bitcoin, as well as a handful of other cryptocurrency payments. Patcheon will work with you to build custom embroidered patches to fit your need, including various backings like adhesive and Velcro. There's no minimum order, so whether you want a big patch or a small patch, one or a thousand, Patcheon is your stop for custom embroidered patches. Check them out today at patcheon.uk.
These ideas that you've posed about revision controlled journalism.
Yeah, so revision controlled journalism, I'm not aware of anyone else using that term, so I'm just going to say that I came up with it, but that might not be the case. I looked very hard and I only saw me using this combination of words. But basically in, I think this was 2016, I started exploring using GitHub as a way to publish my journalistic investigations. And I don't particularly remember what prompted me to do that. I just thought, you know, I need somewhere to publish this, but it's also going to be a long-term investigation. I'm going to make many changes. But I want people to be able to see what my investigation looked like at every point. Like they could go back and see what it looked like when I first created it. And they could also, it was very transparent when I was making changes, the kind of changes I was making. And that was, I think, mostly prompted by the fact that it's always annoyed me reading news online when, you know, when in the context of like a journalist being pressured to make a correction or not being pressured, they just make a correction. And the article has already gotten so much attention that people don't even notice the correction is there because they don't actually like note it as a correction or whatever, but the correction isn't enough. Like it doesn't spread as fast as the incorrect information that was previously in the article. And it's just always, it's bugged a lot of people that history of edits is not transparent for a number of reasons. So I started using GitHub to publish an investigation I was doing. And I thought, well, why don't we engage in, why don't more journalists do this? Like, why don't they make their editing process public, especially for long-term investigations where having that kind of history may be important. And so I came up with this term called revision controlled journalism, which is basically using version control systems, a form of online journalism that uses version control systems for the purposes of contemporaneous timestamping and tracking changes to a story. And in my document, I say, ideally, this model would be implemented using open source intelligence, which is a fancy word for you make your sources, like you include your sources in the piece. And if you look at any of my investigations, like it's a whole giant blob of, you know, blue text hyperlinks, because everything that I include in the investigation is linked to the source that I got it from. And I usually try very hard to not make any claims that are not sourced. I also, as part of the model, I say open source software because it's important. If there's any kind of tooling involved, other people should be allowed to use it and see how it works. I think that's important. You know, it's important in Bitcoin. It's important in a whole bunch of tools. Like I think the reasons of open source software and why it should be open source have been explored, but I think that should be translated into journalism as well. And then I also say like Creative Commons licensing, but that's kind of optional. That's an ideal. But yeah, that's what I've been working on since, I think early 2016. And I've published two documents that kind of explain what it is, like defining it, and also why it's useful. For example, the latest one that I published at the beginning of 2018, I actually, at the start of the document, include a page from a European Commission document that was investigating fake news. And it's particularly funny because one of the pages in that investigation or document or report, it has this page where almost every single line is blacked out. You can't see what it's redacted. You can't see what it says, except for this one sentence in the middle that says, "It is essential to avoid either government or private forms of censorship or ministries of truth," which is a quote from 1984. It's just a very ironic
image. The irony is thick there.
Yeah. So I just thought that was a particularly powerful thing to include in the document that just struck me. And I just needed to put it in there because I thought, like, redactions are also part of it, because with the revision history, that means that if you make a change, it should be difficult to then reverse it. Like, there should be a transparency in, like, if you make a change and you want to undo it, that is also transparent, but you can't, like, erase prior versions of the piece. You have to be accountable for what you've written. Like, journalists do that all the time. They'll make some kind of allegation that they haven't correctly sourced, or the source lied to them, or whatever. They have some kind of agenda, and then when they get pressured to, like, remove it because, hey, this is wrong, or this could potentially harm someone, they remove it, and then there is no evidence outside of maybe someone archived that version of the article, and it's still available in the Internet Archive. But otherwise, there is no evidence of it, and so it like breaks the chain of events, and that can be, you know, detrimental in terms of, you know, a case, or just in terms of documenting, you know, the history of what happens on the Internet. So, yeah, that's kind of a basic overview of, you know, the issues involved with revision control journalism and how it works.
So why do you think other people, whether you want to call it that or call it something, you know, open journalism or whatever people would call it, why do you think mainstream journalism or most journalism doesn't use something like this?
I think I explored this in the first or no, it's okay. I'm just it's okay that you're asking questions over there, 'cause I like to talk about it, but I think it's explored in the first or second document, but I think, let me see.
And we'll include links to all this in the show notes just so everybody can go check it out for themselves as well.
Yeah, I think I actually say in the first document that I published about this, I say journalists and their organizations who rely on non-transparent editorialism and the ex post facto ability to privately amend anything from unintentional mistakes to deception will be less inclined to favor this kind of system, which includes a publicly accessible history of track changes. Journalists and their organizations who rely on their centralized platform of control will be less inclined to favor a system in which their stories could be easily copied and mirrored while maintaining the data integrity. Because especially with GitHub, you know, the point of that is that you can download the repository, you have the complete history of information, and it comes with, you know, a lot of people use it with public key signatures. So that verifies, like, who made the change. And I also say that journalists and organizations who rely heavily on hidden sourcing and privileged access will be less inclined to favor a system which aims to derive its origins and references from publicly available, independently verifiable information. So a related thing, I think I got, because I had an interest in both journalism and Bitcoin, I thought, you know, why are the features of Bitcoin important that, you know, you can verify every transaction yourself if you want to by running a node? That's important in the Bitcoin system, even if you're not mining, because it's self-verifiable. You will know personally, or you can know personally, whether a transaction that you've made has been confirmed. You know the history of transactions, and that's how the network works. It relies on people being able to self-verify and to be able to coordinate with other people and, you know, check with each other to make sure that they're on the same chain, they share the same history, and that's how, you know, that's why the system works. So I thought, well, that's also valuable in journalism. You should be able to self-verify claims that are made in the news that you read. And this is a big problem because so much of what is written by journalists does not do that. They are mostly opinion pieces, or if they're not opinion pieces, they're not willing to share the sources that informed their argument or their opinion about something. And so there's no way to check, like, maybe they were misinformed, or maybe they misinterpreted the source, or something like that. Or maybe they are literally just being intentionally deceptive and there is no evidence for what they're claiming. And they're engaging in misinformation. And obviously that was a big deal around 2016, like with the whole fake news moniker regarding the election. But I think it's generally a problem across topics and areas of interest with journalism, that when they're hiding their sources, like sometimes that's necessary because, you know, the source it can't provide information about themselves or who they are or where they got the information, because to reveal that would put them in a position of danger. But as we've seen with, you know, groups like WikiLeaks, it's possible to still provide source documents about, you know, human rights abuses and things like that, without having to de-anonymize the source, because they've built the system in a way that they themselves should not even know who their source is. You're able to anonymously submit documents that should be able to speak for themselves regarding, you know, just a coincidence of timing of the like certain information or dates that are included, or as is often the case with WikiLeaks' releases, if they're including emails, a lot of them are using signatures. Like Google uses something called DKIM, which is basically signatures on emails associated with, you know, the identity of the account. And this is one of the ways that they verify the integrity of the leaks of emails. They can verify the signatures. So yeah, I think that's like, there, I still think source protection is necessary in a lot of circumstances, but we should be finding ways to make it easier to provide sources so that there is less opportunity for malicious people to use the lack of sourcing to, and, you know, the willingness of readers to trust what they're reading, to manipulate, you know, people's opinions about, you know, anything from what did an individual celebrity eat for breakfast, all the way up to, you know, who was doing what in a highly controversial criminal case.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you went into that. That was going to be my question, was your thoughts on when you don't want to dox a source, or by including their information, you put them at danger. But I guess if they can provide source material that reports and such, then that's easier because it doesn't have to be their word involved.
Yeah, and another thing I'll mention in regards to that is what's particularly powerful about cryptography in this instance that could be used for that purpose is you could make a cryptographic hash commitment where, if for anyone who's not familiar with cryptography, you could input a certain amount of data, like, for example, someone's name, anything from someone's name to, you know, an entire document, and you could make a hash of this and then publish that. And that allows you to, you know, it makes a fingerprint of that information in a way that you can share it, and it doesn't reveal what that information was, what the input was for the algorithm. But at a later point in time, you could say, here's what I hashed. If you put this same information that I had into this algorithm, it will produce this output, which I published, you know, 7 months ago or whatever. And so you can prove that I had this information at this time, as long as, because the powerful part of Bitcoin, obviously, is the timing involved. And so you could even publish this hash using Bitcoin in the operturn field. And that would prove that you had this information, this hash existed at a certain period of time, and here's the input data for that. And so, for example, you could include a hash of maybe your source's name in a piece and say, here's the person who gave me this information. I can't reveal it right now, but once it is safe for this source to reveal themselves, they can, and I can prove that this was the source that I originally included in the piece. I think that would be an interesting mechanism to use, and it has been used in a few cases, like just by independent journalists, but I don't think it's ever been used in anything particularly influential. But I think that would be an interesting way to use cryptography as part of journalism.
Yeah, I think that's kind of similar to what Peter Todd's worked on with open timestamps, right?
Yeah, his open timestamps project is actually one of the tools that I mention I would want to use in my second document about it. I think I have like an elements of the model section, and then the last section is an overview of tools. This isn't necessarily what I would end up using. It's just kind of, I wanted to provide a list of different things that could potentially serve various purposes as part of the model. And open timestamps is one of the things, because it's the definition of open timestamps is a free and open source trust minimized timestamping service and standard using the Bitcoin blockchain to establish a proof that some data existed prior to some point in time. It's not only a trust minimized mechanism, but I think it's also a minimalist way to use something like Bitcoin for journalism in a way that's not also potentially destructive to the system, because I've seen a number of projects try to, you know, use a blockchain as a place to store, like, not even hashes of information or hashes of documents, but actually entire plain text documents. In the case of Ethereum now, obviously, you know, in Ethereum, you can do that. And the people who did it, I think it was as part of like a Me Too thing in China. Obviously, I wouldn't blame them for doing that, because obviously if they're in a position where they have to get some information out, and they want it to be censorship resistant. So the thing that people need is censorship resistant. So the question is, how can you build a system for journalism to be censorship resistant, which is the desired feature, but also not destroy the underlying system if everyone adopts that same way of, acquiring the censorship resistant property. And so open timestamps is deliberately minimalist in terms of how it uses Bitcoin as a way to timestamp documents in a way that's meaningful without, dumping information into the Bitcoin blockchain and then taking up block space, and that, increases fees, and various, chain effects from that. So that's particularly why I included it. And just, I think, doing timestamping in that way is preferable to some of the other projects I've seen that are trying to combine journalism and blockchains.
Very cool. Very cool. All right. Well, Janine, this has been a really cool talk and a very informative interview for me, if not for anybody else. But how else can we keep up with your work?
My main public social media account is Twitter, which is at J9Roem, J9Roem. I also have, obviously, what I mentioned was the podcast, Block Digest, which is on YouTube. There's also a Twitter account at Block Digest if you can't find it. And that's mainly the two places where I'm publicly engaged with people. I have other methods of contact, but you can find those through my Twitter account.
Very cool. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. This is a great opportunity.
Well, real quick before you go, are there ways that people can support your work, or, I mean, besides just, watching or listening to Block Digest or reading along with your stuff, because that, my understanding, you're independent journalist, right?
At the moment, yes, I'm an independent journalist, and I haven't made any steps to really monetize any of my work. And I'm not particularly, I don't feel that that's an urgency right now, but Okay. Obviously I would have to do that in the future to be sustainable. I don't have a public Bitcoin donation address. I should probably do that at some point. In the meantime, Block Digest has a donation address, so you can use that if you would like to support that effort, because Block Digest is really where I put out a lot of the information and topics and events that I'm focusing on at any given time.
Very cool. All right. Well, we will look and listen for you there then.
Thank you.
All right, guys, that's the show for today. What did you think? That was a lot of fun to do, and I think you guys should go follow Janine on Twitter and check out Block Digest. Those are both good resources. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter at BottomShelfBTC, and you know the drill. If you want to support the show, the best way to do that is by subscribing so you don't miss any episodes, and then by sharing it and inundating all of your social network links with the episodes. If you are looking for a way to do more direct financial support, you can check out bottomshelfbitcoin.com/donate. There's links there to my Tallycoin page, as well as a ref link for the Tuttle Twins books. Remember, those books are about liberty and free market economics and things like that. So you should check those out. If you've got kids, or you know kids, or you know, even if you're just looking to find an easy entry into these ideas, they are a great way to kind of get your feet wet in these ideas before you move on to and so, like, most of them are actually based on the bigger books by people like Rothbard or Bastiat, or even some of Ron Paul's works. So check these books out. They're kind of a condensed version with a fun story about these kids that learn these lessons along the way about liberty and free market economics and some of these ideas, and just put in a very simplified format that you can understand very quickly. So check those out. It doesn't cost you anything extra if you buy through my ref link. I just get a little bit of a kickback towards the show for sending you their way. So, and they're great books. You should check them out. All right. I think that is going to do it for today. Lots of show notes for you to click through about the things that Janine was talking about. So check those out. That may be my longest note section yet. Definitely one of the longer episodes, but it's a lot of fun. I like these longer episodes, and I hope you do too. All right, from Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, I'm Josh Humphrey. Thanks for listening.